Accession number 15228, reel 2.
This is Geoffrey Amor, side 2. So you're talking about the spit 7.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the controls at low level were comparatively heavy because of the seals around the cockpits, the control runs through the cockpit wall. And we were being used mostly at low level at that stage. The high level threat had pretty well gone, so we were doing shipping patrols and strikes and things down across the into France in support, obviously, of the invasion, going in over the Channel Islands, which is a very long sea crossing, and down to the Loire Valley and into that sort of area, before we moved up to Manston. But I remember once after we got to Manston in July, going off on a high-level sortie on a beautifully gin-clear day. I forget the service ceiling of the aircraft, but I remember getting this one up to about, I think, probably 42,000 feet, and being able to see the whole of the south of England from Dover to Land's End, and beyond that, the curvature of the Earth. And now it's commonplace. You go in an airliner at 40,000 feet, it's there. But in those days, that was the first time I can ever recall seeing it on one of those perfect days. So they were a lovely aircraft at altitude, but a bit heavy, low level.
Of course, you were pretty close to your stalling speed flat out at that altitude. You?
Well, I think you had a fair margin. You had a fair margin up there. Yeah. But then, with the advent of the meteor coming along, the day we arrived at Manston, our hangar was on the opposite side to the main airfield. And Manston, do you know Manston at all? Yeah. It was one of three airfields on the East Coast developed as emergency runways. There was Manston near Ramsgate and Margate, Woodbridge near Ipswich, and Carnaby in Yorkshire, with runways that were 3,000 yards with a 500-yard prepared undershoot and overshoot, and three times the normal width. Certainly the one at Manston had Fido, where they burnt the petrol, the fog dispersal, for aircraft coming back in distress. And for the period we spent there, there were some sights to be seen of aircraft coming back in a bad state, crews bailing out in the circuit whilst the pilot tried to land it, all sorts of things. It was an exciting place to be. But we were on the far side in this one hangar, and when we got there, it was locked. And there were two ME-109s in it. They had been intruding the night before. It is thought that they had running short of fuel as they were heading home, and they thought crossed over the Thames estuary, thinking it was the channel, and landed at the first airfield. That was Manston. Because they followed the lights and went in, and the chaps on the ground spotted what they were. They put some bowsers around them so they couldn't get out, and they got the two pilots. But the two aircraft were shut in our hangar. That was our move to Manston. Then they basically formed the squadron into two flights, the Meteor flight and the Spitfire flight. So the senior chaps were in the Meteor flight, and we juniors were in the Spits and continuing to operate and doing our spell on standby and weather recces over the continent in the mornings and these sort of things until time went on when we then sort of got onto the meters as well. So I think the official date for the conversion was July the 12th. I think I flew my first meter on perhaps the 20th
of July, 1944.
And then the Spitfires disappeared and we continued to re-equip with a Meteor. So they were exciting days. We thought, obviously, we were the bee's knees, the aircraft was secret, no one had seen anything like it before. In fact, no one was allowed near the dispersal. The first two aircraft, numbers EE213 and 214/G, guard, which we were briefed that if we went down on another airfield for some reason, we could request an armed guard or a locked hangar, because they were secret. That was it, 2 and 3 and 2 and 4. Quite different, obviously, from the Spitfire. They were tricycle undercarriage, twin-engined, no nose in front of you, no noise or vibration within the cockpit, no experience of the engines, no instructors, no dual aircraft, no pilot's notes, but a test pilot from Farnborough, a wing commander, Wilson, who, as group captain, Wilson, the next year, was the first to get the speed record of 6.06 on the Meteor, before it was taken up the next year later to 6.16 for the high-speed flight under Commodore Donaldson. And he had a sheet of, he had notes on one side of a sheet of foolscap, and I remember him sort of saying, well, go away and read those, think about them, and then come back and tell me, which is what we did. And my flight commander, after a reunion last year at Manston, when being interviewed by Southern TV, said, when he was asked the question, what sort of training and conversion, and he said, well, we were given a set of notes, go away and read them, come back when you finish, which I did. And I said, what do I do now? And he said, now get in and fly the damn thing. And this probably summed up, you know, that was about it. The engines were the original Welland. We were not allowed to use them as a twin-engine aircraft to taxi. We had to sort of set the throttle. They had to be use them very carefully. We had a brake on the nose wheel as well as the main wheels, which was eventually dispensed with. It was wasn't a very good idea. We had no air brakes. We had a lift-up canopy as opposed to a sliding canopy. The first two were not armed. Very underpowered. I think about 1,600 pounds of static thrust, but at very high revs, something like 17,000. And so we used to take them up to full revs on the brakes and let them go, and hopefully that both engines would keep going, and then get airborne, throttle back a bit, and eventually build up to speed. So they're very slow to accelerate, but on the other hand, they were very slow to decelerate, because they were clean, the lines were clean, there were no propellers to give you a braking effect, and so you had to anticipate your slowing down, coming back into the circuit. And when we started formation flying, if you were trying to, catching up another aircraft up, you had to start throttling back a long time before you ever got to him, otherwise you'd just overshoot and come back. So those are the sort of differences. We had
if you had to do an overshoot, the engines took quite a bit of time.
Yes, it did. Very slow to respond. So you had to try and judge your approach pretty carefully. And you watched two things, I suppose. Your jet pipe temperature, which was crucial. They were quite high. I think you could go up to about 700 degrees. But they were critical. And the other thing was the fuel. I think the internal capacity, if I remember rightly, of the Meteor was about 325 gallons. But at low level, that used to just disappear. In 40 minutes, you were in trouble, just flying around at low level, as opposed to a Spitfire where, you could go on for an hour and a half. So those are the two things we had to watch, I suppose, most carefully. Engine handling, jet pipe temperature, and fuel.
What about rate of climb? Was that spectacular or not?
Not particularly. The zoom climb was quite spectacular. Having built up the speed and then go up to full throttle, and then you could zoom, and you could go up several thousand feet in the zoom, which would then outpace the latest Spitfire or Tempest. But the actual rate of climb, you sort of started from low level. No, it wasn't spectacular in that sense. No.
But the speed was, once you built it up.
And the speed was 400 plus in those days, even then. So that was really quite fast. Really quite fast in those days, in that original aircraft. But it was underpowered. There's no doubt about that. And it had a few of these extraordinary things. I think, as I said the other night on takeoff, we used to have trouble with the nose wheel not locking up. And we found that instead of lifting a nose wheel off at perhaps 90 knots, we were keeping all three on the ground. And this was the nose wheel, the tire was spreading, catching the little mud guard, which was in buckling, preventing the thing locking up. So we learned from that to lift the nose wheel off and fly it off like...
The nose wheel wouldn't retract in that state, then?
No, it didn't used to retract in that state. We had another... one of the things, obviously, when you start equipping with new aircraft is an accident on no accidents. But unfortunately, we did have a few, inevitably. And the first, if I remember rightly, was the squadron commander who ran out of fuel and put it into a field. And the crew that went out to recover him took with them two old propellers and laid up against the front of the engine to fool the locals or any Germans who might have been lurking around the area. And then we had another dreadful incident where the meter with this very high tailplane, when you're taxiing downwind in a strong wind, the stick would really go forward, backwards, and forwards. It really took quite a lot of effort to hold it. And on this occasion, it was taxiing in, and when it came back, the gun firing, the safety flap on the gun firing button, it obviously caught into the parachute cockpit harness, and it opened unbeknown to the pilot. And when the stick next came back with a gust of wind, it actually fired the cannons, pointing at another aircraft on dispersal, and sort of made a mess of that and one or two of the chaps who were working on it. So they had to fit a micro switch in the undercarriage circuit so that the guns wouldn't fire unless the wheels were actually locked up. And we went up and physically checked each airplane by throttling right back over the sea, putting the nose down, trying to keep the speed below 150, which was the maximum speed for wheels, and press the button, fire the guns at the same moment, putting the undercarriage down to check that it physically stopped firing as the wheels started to go down. Very unfortunate. Another one I remember was shot at hit by a Spitfire returning, who had to confess he didn't know there was such a thing as a jet aircraft. Not an RAF jet aircraft. Any jet was German, so he had to go at it. Then we used to get the engines that the would blow up. The bearings would go, and at 17,000 revs or near, it could be fairly disastrous. And one could see perhaps the bottom of the engine itself sort of blowing out. So we had a number of accidents of that sort. And the chap who I actually joined the squadron with, I think was the first fatal. He went in when he was trying to land at a strip in Kent at a village called High Holden, which we used for these V1 patrols. We had a patrol line between Ashford and Tenterden, and High Holden was down in that area. Poor old Greggy was the first to go in there. And some wag, I remember, at Gloucester, I wish I could find it, he wrote a poem as such on based on the 10 green bottles. Of there were 10 little meters all in the line, one ran out of fuel, and then there were 9. But I can't remember any more, but I think he got down to 0.
Did you come across the so-called phantom dive that they talked about it at that stage?
No, not that stage. No, we hadn't gotten dive brakes, or air brakes, at that stage. No, that came later. Oh, yes, one became aware of this.
Perhaps we could go on and talk about that on later marks.
But a little bit later.
I'm interested now in your operational experiences of the meteor.
Well, mine wasn't very much, because I did a few V1 patrols, and in fact intercepted one or two, but I was about number 7 in line. There were other aircraft sort of all waiting, lining up to shoot the thing down, and we were very much inland. At that time, I suppose there were one or two aircraft patrol lines out to sea, an enormous anti-aircraft barrage right along the coast, the south coast, enormous barrage. And we had a line from Ashford to Tenterden, which gave us, I think, 2 minutes or rather less to intercept before he got to the balloon bar south of London. So, no. I saw, I think, two or three, but never got at them. So in that sense, not a great deal. And then, of course, it died down, and we went on with fairly normal flying after that until January 45, we moved to Cologne, near Bath, which became the first real, jet station, where future squadrons then trained and converted. And in February 45, four aircraft were painted white and went across to the continent, really for identification purposes with the gunners over there. And I went out, I think, on the second lot, about a fortnight later, towards the end of February, another chap and I. Again, I think the first two sergeant pilots who went out there, we were at Melsbrook at Brussels. And there I had a... on one day, you know, thinking back, you see, it all comes back. You think you'd have an air compressor on the engines for your brakes and things like that, but we didn't. There wasn't an air compressor. They used to stuff in about 420 pounds... 420 pounds per square inch into a bottle, which had to last you, taxiing out, landing, taxiing back in again. And on one of these, I came in one day when I was at Brussels, and my air pressure, I must admit, was getting a bit low, but there's nothing I could do about that. I tried to swing it round in dispersal and just caught a wingtip on one of the fuel bowsers, which wasn't very clever, so it had to be an accident report. And I was on duty, the duty pilot, next afternoon, and the station commander rang up. And he said, you're just the chap. And he told me, he said, what was wrong with your air pressure? Wasn't the compressor working? So I had to enlighten him. We didn't have one. So anyway, nothing too much came in there.
Would that have been too much of a load on the engine to run a
compressor? I would have thought, you know, it just hadn't got to the stage of finding a place to put another spindle, another drive. To do it, the easiest way is put a bottle in, pump it up with air, until they got more time to develop it. I would have thought. I don't know.
What use were meters put to?
Well, over there. Mm. Well, initially, just that identification for our guns and our troops. But that didn't last very long, because we then came back to an airfield, Wethersfield, up in Suffolk, Cambridgeshire, Suffolk, because there was then another V1 threat, another threat, as I understand it. So we were pulled back for that, which didn't last, and that didn't seem to materialise. So we then reformed as a whole squadron, all with the Mark IIIs. We went back to the continent again at the beginning of April, into Brussels, then up into Holland, and there we were really after trying to find German aircraft, the jet, V-jet, because they'd got their 262s, ME-262s operational. And we moved forward very rapidly from Brussels to Gilsrhein to Nijmegen to Quackenbrook in Germany. But we were restricted in that we were not allowed to go over the front line, again, because they were still, at least to some extent, secret. And so you couldn't get that way. So there wasn't much to do. We went on then to Fassberg. And then in the last week, I suppose, we went Fassberg, Celle, and finished up at Lübeck, an airfield just south of Lübeck, with the Russians literally on the eastern end of the runway. And only in that last week were we allowed to go over the front line. And then we were basically used for strafing, ground strafing, and because of all the Germans coming, tending to come this way, away from the Russians. But one of our biggest problems there, I suppose, was our own Spitz and Tempest. I see two jet aircraft flashing around the sky, which tended to leave small smoke trails. The only aircraft that were jets out there were Germans.
Of course, you've had twin engines on the wings, like the 262.
Absolutely, absolutely. So they were a nuisance in that sense. And unfortunately, in that last week, of the war, our Spitfire squadron commander, a squadron of the Watts, who, when we got jets, became a flight commander because we had a wing commander posted in Andrew McDowell. He and a flight sergeant were both killed in the last week of the war. And it is thought they...
accidents or operations?
It was thought they were out on an operational mission, but it is thought they collided in cloud. That was a pretty tough game, wasn't it, last week of the war. Mm. So, you know, there we were.
Why do you think you were chosen to fly the Meteor? I mean, one would have thought, were you an elite mob? Or?
Why the squadron was chosen? I've no idea. I've no idea at all. Never seen any reference to it. Whether it was something put in the hat. I tend to think, looking back, that there's no doubt the high altitude threat had gone, for which the Mark 7 was designed, and we were, having been being a Mark 7 squadron, then probably it was logical to replace one of those. But other than that, I've no idea. And the likes of myself being a pilot on that squadron, well, that was just sheer luck. Just having to be posted into it.
So you never got to fly Typhoons?
Nope. I subsequently flew Tempest, mind you, but not the Typhoon.
Just on a social point of view, when you first got your wings and you got your sergeant stripes, and you were, what, 19, 20, something like that?
Yeah,
how did you go down in the sergeant's mess among all the old sweat?
well, not too easily in some places. Let's think. I think probably after you'd got your wings and you were doing your advanced training before going off to squadrons, you'd go to these places. And, of course, all the old sweats, as you say, the sergeant, looked upon you as the youngsters coming up. And you were privileged because of rationing. I think rationing was probably one egg a week. If you were flying, you had six. You also got a small chocolate ration, which they didn't get. You could also pull your rank, that if you're late for breakfast but you're on the flying program, you could demand a breakfast. You had to eat before you... if you were stupid enough to sort of do that, then there's reasons why people should look at you a bit sideways. But then when you look, got at them sometimes, if some people are being a bit ornery and say, okay, well, when did you join? And you joined last year, and they were runway controllers, suddenly promoted sergeant. And I said, well, steady on, old boy. I've been in 3 or 4 years now as an ex-apprentice. So they were not all old sweats. There were some genuine old sweats and some were not. But
the other factor also, of course, you were facing an awful lot more danger as air crew than ground crew were.
Yeah, yeah. But we didn't think about that, did you? Not at that age. Mm. And you were paid the same, No, you didn't think about that. See, I always think that, there were sergeant pilots pre-war of two categories. One who are the regular airmen, who are then promoted sergeant, and who could then revert to being a corporal, fitter, still retaining the wings but lose the rank. And there were some direct entry sergeant pilots who came in to be pilots and who would not be commissioned but who become sergeant pilots. And I can remember at the beginning of the war, their pay was 12 and 6 a day. That seemed like a fortune to me. I think as an LAC, Group 1 tradesman, mine as an LAC was 6 shillings. They got more than twice as much. I thought, why? That's what I want to be. When you think back, it was a pittance, wasn't it? The Battle of Britain, chaps. This is what some of them were getting, 12 and 6 a day.
How were commissions decided?
I have no idea at all. One would like to think that the chaps who showed the right qualities all the way through, not in their flying ability, but in their social abilities,
Did leadership come into it?
I'm sure it must have. After that, to begin with, I don't know. After that, I was commissioned just after the end of the war, when I think... Looking back, I think the squadron commander, and I'll come back to the squadron commander, he's an interesting chap. I think, called in sort of at about the end of the wartime, after things had settled down a little bit, and he said, "Why? What are you chaps going to do? You're a regular airman, or you have been. Are you going to stay in? Are you going? Why don't you? You ought to be commissioned, you know, after this. Why don't you apply?" And I think that's how it came about. So I applied. And Johnny Johnson, the fighter ace, was the station commander at Lubeck, and Harry Broadhurst was the AOC up at Sleswick. And I went through those and was commissioned at the end of May, 1945. But Andrew McDowell, who became the squadron commander when we first got Meteors, was replaced about a week before the end of the war. And a young New Zealander, Smokey Schrader, who was commanding a Tempest squadron as a squadron leader, was promoted and moved across. He came straight in, and said, and we briefed him on the meteor. He flew the meteor in that last week of the war. He'd already got a DFC or two. He was obviously a very go-ahead chap at that stage. Anyway, he then commanded the squadron up to about autumn, I suppose. We changed numbers. We were at Lubeck, and we were there until end of July, August, 45, when 616, being an auxiliary, the number reverted to an auxiliary squadron, and we became 263 as a regular squadron. And then we came back to the UK. And he left us a month or two after that, I suppose. And, you know, lost touch, that was it. 1956 to 58, I had the great good fortune to be posted to New Zealand on an exchange tour to the New Zealand Air Force. And they had one home-based jet fighter squadron, just the one. And I went out and commanded it, number 75. At their station called Ohakia, about 90 miles north of Wellington. And I had my 16 aircraft. I had a responsibility for the other 14 Vampires, which belonged to the training unit, but I had responsibility for the daily provision of those. So I had the fleet, the total New Zealand fleet of 30 Vampires out there. And
what marks were those?
They were the 5... the T-11, and two others which were variants, 33s and 35s. They're just really variants of the 5 and the T-11. One of my small extra jobs as a squadron commander there was to refresh a very, very few reserve pilots, probably no more than half a dozen throughout the country. And I had this one chap come in, one day, and the usual thing, on the Monday morning, I had him into the office and talked to him before he started flying. What did he do, etc. And he was a co-pilot on their NAC, their National Airways Corporation, I think flying Dakotas at that time. And we chatted on. And at the same time, the local airport at Palmerston North, which was Grass, was having a hard runway put down. And so the aircraft that used that were using our airfield at Ohakia. And I said to this chap, I had a New Zealand squadron commander right last few days of the war and a few months after, a chap called Smokey Schrader. He said, God, he said, I fly with him frequently. He's one of our captains. So I said, well, for goodness sake, when you go back, just see if he remembers me. And if so, you know, I'd like to hear from him. And he said, well, we land here occasionally because Palmerston North is closed. So he said, I'll get him to get in touch with you when he next comes in. So I had a ring one evening a bit later. He said, it's me. I've come in. I've landed here. We're staying the night. So I said, well, come on over, you know, we'll have a party. And we did. And, you know, so when I met him, you see, I was a flight sergeant or warrant officer, I suppose, pilot initially. And here was I, a squadron commander. He was a civilian. And, you know, I always thought, as I suppose one did, squadron commander, quite a bit older than you. He was just 2 years older than me. So at the end of the war, he was probably 23, a wing commander.